It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, February 12th, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. States are dropping mask mandates, but the CDC says it's too soon.
There is no one golden standard data point that's going to tell us when it is appropriate to lift mask mandates.
And bipartisanship breaks out on Capitol Hill.
They're not doing Build Back Better. They're not changing the filibuster. So you look at the legislative traffic, and there's not a lot out there.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Masks are coming off across the country, at least masks worn because of mandates at state or local levels. Just this week, several states, led by Democrats, began winding down some COVID-related protocols. California will allow its indoor mask mandate to expire next week. New York is ending a vaccine or mask requirement for businesses. Rhode Island, Oregon, Nevada, Delaware, Colorado, and others are all lifting rules for masking. New Jersey's governor says next month students can stop wearing masks at school. But as governors and local leaders start putting an end to those requirements, the CDC is not recommending the same, at least not yet. The White House insists the president will continue to follow scientific data. What is the data telling us now, nearly 2 years into the pandemic? Is it time for the CDC to shift strategies? We start there this week with Dr. Syra Madad, the senior director of the Special Pathogens Program at NYC Health Plus Hospitals.
You know, many of the governors that are, lifting these mask mandates are the same governors that have done well in terms of trying to, apply these pandemic mitigation measures in a way that could be used for the collective good. And so my point is that, they certainly are in a moment trying to figure out what is best for their state. So it's not as if they're saying, let's just lift all these mask mandates and, let the kind of the virus spread. That's not the thinking. So they are trying to be mindful because we are at a pivotal moment in this pandemic. And the reason why I say we're in a pivotal moment is we're in a transition period where we're looking at removing these, these pandemic mitigation measures like masking, and now relying on individuals to look at their own risk tolerance, their own risk profile, and thinking, should I continue to mask? Should I go to these indoor events? And so as we move forward, and as you've mentioned, there is no one golden standard data point that's going to tell us when it is appropriate to lift mask mandates. So it's not just relying on community transmission levels. And as you've alluded to, CDC's, website where you look at the county level tracker, over 99% of counties in the United States are still in high levels of community transmission. But if you look at hospitalization rates, they certainly are declining. Ideally, when we look at a metric, we wanted, hospitalization rates to be 10 cases per 100,000. No state really meets that criteria. When we look at vaccination rates, that certainly varies from state to state as well. So there is no one particular metric that's going to tell us when it's appropriate to lift mask mandates. Instead, we should look at all of these different epidemiological factors, along with access-based factors. So this includes, how many people have access to testing, how many people have obviously access to vaccinations, even though they're widely available, there's still barriers in place. So my thinking is certainly we should start evaluating when it is the appropriate time to lift mask mandates. And that's going to vary from city to city. And we need to empower our local mayors and school superintendents to see what works best for their community as they look at lifting these types of measures.
One thing that I have heard from policymakers, from elected officials, is that the CDC has not been real clear on what should trigger a change in policy, that the CDC has sort of just kept everything in place and hasn't provided any guidance as far as, what certain metric needs to be reached. And so these governors and local leaders are kind of left to their own experts without a lot of guidance from the top down. Is that how you see it? Should the CDC be more clear in letting states, letting counties, letting cities know what the environment ought to look like before taking a new step?
Oh, absolutely. I think we need to have a general framework in place that these are the different types of combination of metrics and benchmarks that we want different localities to reach in order for them to start lifting mask mandates and, you know, other types of mitigation measures. And that doesn't exist. In fact, the only measure right now that as we look at CDC's website is that county level community transmission rate. Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself is quite flawed because it's looking at, you know, case positivity. And it's also looking at obviously number of cases over a 7-day average, but it's not factoring in the rapid at-home test that is just so widely available. Millions of people are doing that test every day, but that's not being factored into their analysis. So their method or their metric certainly is flawed. And as we are hearing, CDC is looking at revising some of their metrics and thinking, should we go more with hospitalization and as well as a combination of community transmission levels. So I do think that it would be very beneficial to have a federal level framework that localities can, you know, essentially look at as they make their local decisions. And unfortunately, that doesn't exist. And as you've mentioned, now there's a hodgepodge of different states kind of figuring out for their for themselves what works best for them. And that's not something that we should be in this, you know, kind of 2 years plus into this pandemic.
It's the CDC being too cautious.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's good to be cautious, but at the same time, we need to adapt quickly because this virus certainly obviously continues to evolve. And I think the CDC's approach is always kind of waiting for the data, waiting for better, you know, scientific information before changing any guidance. And oftentimes that delay costs, you know, a lot of issues and confusion as we're seeing right now. So their framework should have been updated, but it's not. And it's very unfortunate.
If mask mandates sort of in the general public stay in place, is there data to support at least lifting mask mandates for schools that still have those in place?
Well, I think when we start having the discussion of lifting mask mandates in schools, I think that there are certain counties that, you know, probably meet the kind of the benchmark. And when I mean meet the benchmark, if you have high vaccination rates in a particular county and you know your cases are declining, I think that's a moment where you want to think, you know, maybe it's appropriate to start lifting these mask requirements. But if you're in an area with very low vaccination rates, and we do have still many counties that have low vaccination rates, and you're seeing cases are declining, but they're still very high, you may want to wait, you know, a few more weeks. And unfortunately, that's kind of going back to the same point of everybody's kind of following their own framework. And it's, you know, really unfortunate. We know masking works. We know that risk reduction in this pandemic, you know, is really important. So it's not just about masking, it's about ventilation. It's also about making sure that we are able to prevent, you know, cases from becoming clusters, and we're able to isolate and quarantine. So all these things work together. And we need to make sure if we are peeling back one measure, for example, masking, that schools have good ventilation systems in place. And we know the American Rescue Plan, you know, has been offering billions of dollars to do that. And we want to make sure schools are looking into that.
I think that's one of the frustrations that you've heard from parents is all of this money's been spent to upgrade the schools. Why are kids still wearing masks? And, you know, given the data out there that would suggest that children aren't nearly as impacted by the effects of COVID as older Americans.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that we want to make sure that as we look at the data, we certainly know, you know, 2 years into this pandemic, children are affected, but not to the extent as adults. We have safe and effective vaccines for those over the age of 5. Unfortunately, vaccination rates, in teens and children have plateaued. So relying on just increasing vaccination rates and then lifting mask mandates, that's a fantasy. We're not going to get there, unfortunately. And that's where we want to make sure that we have better ventilation and filtration systems in schools, even if they have low vaccination rates. And I think that would give you kind of a better, you know, as a parent, feeling a little bit more comfortable that, hey, even though mask mandates are removed, I have an option of still masking my child if my child is vulnerable and I, you know, have a lower risk tolerance. But we know other measures in schools are in place, not just for COVID, right? We need to also expand it out to other infectious diseases. And we've been so hyper-focused on COVID, and rightfully so, because that's been, you know, the issue. We also want to look at it from the mental health standpoint of children and what they're facing and the myriad other, you know, health challenges that they continue to face. We need to have a holistic picture as we make these decisions.
Are there studies that show the mental health effects of kids in classrooms wearing these masks for a prolonged period of time?
So, you know, there's a lot of anecdotal information. As we know, anecdotal doesn't mean facts. So as we look at masking, we know masking is beneficial. We know that it reduces transmission rates. As we look at, you know, what are the risks associated with masking, there's no, you know, medical related risks associated with masking, but there's more social risk, right? So you're not able to see faces of teachers and peers and students. And that certainly has an effect on children. It has a mental health effect on children because they're constantly being masked, in indoor environments for a prolonged period of time. And they're not able to look at many of the visual cues. So there's so many other kind of other impacts. In fact, if we look at the mental health challenge that's plaguing our children, I mean, it is significant enough that CDC certainly has published papers that show emergency department visits have been on the rise in children, unfortunately, with mental health challenges and psychological issues. And so we want to make sure we are making, as I mentioned, decisions on a whole, looking at these data points.
Do you still have confidence that what we're getting from the CDC is the best data available at the time, sort of up to the minute recommendations are acceptable or the right call?
Well, I think the data in and of itself is not in real time. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. I think the information that we are seeing, the data points, there are lagging by at least 2 weeks. So we certainly need to change our data reporting, collection, analyzing, and make sure we're shifting it more to real time. And that's just not happening. And so we need to make sure that as we look at these 7 and 14 day averages, that's what we're basing, you know, our decisions on, not day to day, because, you know, the numbers are not really in real time. I do think that the CDC needs to do a much better job in helping track these case numbers, hospitalizations, and so many other metrics in a much more orderly fashion where we can get this information in real time. And that's unfortunately just not happening right now.
I'll finish with this. What is your advice to governors, to local leaders who are ready to lift these types of mask mandates? You know, we've seen it in New York, we've seen it in Virginia, we've seen it in places that, as you point out, have had these protocols in place now for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first is that the decision certainly has to be made at the local level. I would want to make sure that these mayors and these school superintendents are looking at, you know, the community transmission levels. They are looking at hospitalizations and hospital capacity in their particular area. And they're also encouraging, as we're shifting from a collective, you know, everybody's masking to now individual level, that they're giving the option to parents and children that if you want to continue masking, you can still do that. And we know one-way masking is still, you know, highly effective, and that we're making sure that we're telling them that if you want to, you know, if you need testing, testing is available, and have these resources available. Because we know that in this pandemic, people of color have been disproportionately affected. So we need to make sure that we're looking at it from the lens of equity as well. So we need to give them those tools and resources, and they exist, right? We're in a very different time period. We just need to make sure we're much more methodical in using this and letting people know, giving clear message that right now we're lifting masks, you know, mask mandates, and we have these tools for you. And that if, the metrics and data change, that we may reimpose it. So there is a clear understanding that these are off ramps, but we may have to reimplement depending on the situation. We're in a shape shifting situation, and things will continue to change moving forward.
Well, it's been a long time that we've been talking about this. I appreciate your insight as always, Dr. Madad. We'll continue to catch up as these decisions are made, and we want to sort of get the science and data behind these decisions. So I thank you as always.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Bipartisanship broke out on Capitol Hill this week. Really? Consider this. Just this week, Congress, with overwhelming bipartisan support, passed one of the most significant changes in employment law in decades. Legislation ending companies from forcing victims of sexual harassment and assault into arbitration.
You're going to have a right today that you did not have yesterday. You're going to have a chance to be heard differently.
That's South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, who for years worked on a legislative package with New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand.
Allowing them to have their day in court, a basic constitutional right.
Also this week, the long-stalled Postal Service Reform Bill passed the House, 342-92. The bill is intended to save the Postal Service billions of dollars. Top Democrats and Republicans on the House and Senate Appropriations Committees have also reached a deal, they say, on a long-term spending bill to fund government through September. And unlikely political bedfellows are coming together on new legislation that would ban members of Congress and potentially their immediate families from buying and selling individual stocks.
This is all about restoring some trust and confidence in an institution that has one of the lowest approval ratings in America. I think Congress is below root canals now.
Montana Republican Steve Daines introducing a bill with Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren.
No one in this country should ever have to wonder what motivates a lawmaker.
The Warren-Daines proposal is one of several out there in the House. Virginia Democrat Abigail Spanberger has teamed up with Texas Republican Chip Roy on a bill requiring lawmakers to put stocks and other investments in the blind trust. Other members of Congress are floating similar proposals. The idea even has the attention of congressional leaders like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who once was cool to the idea. So that's where we will start this week with my colleague on Capitol Hill, Fox News congressional correspondent Chad Pergram, and discuss what's behind the sudden bipartisan spirit taking hold.
Well, it's amazing how quickly this issue has kind of bubbled up. You know, just in December, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that she was against, you know, changing the trading rules of stocks for members of Congress. Now she wants something that's universal across government. At her press conference in the past couple of days, she talked in particular about changing the rules for the judiciary. They're not under any, rules at all about what they can trade. And so it's an issue of transparency. You have had some members come forth who say, oh, we're against this. You know, we are human beings. We are citizens. There should be some things that we are allowed to do in the private sector. And one of them is Tommy Tuberville, Republican senator from Alabama. He's been pretty outspoken about this. There are some Democrats as well. But, you know, you might remember, you know, there have been occasions where members have talked about putting their stocks in a blind trust. There have been problems with that. I remember there was an issue about 16, 17 years ago with Bill Frist, who was the Senate Majority Leader, Republican from Tennessee, and was tinkering with running for president in 2008. And, you know, there have been some suggestions that other senators and other members have not been on the up and up with their stock trading, even though they say it's in a blind trust. It is kind of in the eye of the beholder here about, what you should be able to do. You know, I think probably the reason this has caught fire right now is some members think that it's an issue of transparency. Mm-hmm. And the more transparent and open they are being about what they do, and if you're not actually trading stocks and getting rich off of something, that just puts you in a better light, frankly.
Well, let's talk about what the requirements are now, because right now they're bound by what's called the Stock Act, right, which requires lawmakers and I think their close family to essentially disclose every stock transaction they make,
yes.
Right?
And not so, and also not adhere to or not use, quote unquote, insider information that you
get. Well, but that's already
job.
Illegal. I mean, insider trading's still illegal, right? And
right.
That's bound
but,
by members
right,
of Congress.
Right, but there was a distinction. There's a distinction here, Jared, that's interesting. They were saying that members of Congress, you know, are privy to, and staff, frankly, are privy to all sorts of information that the rest of the world is not. And some of that is true, but some of that is them doing their job. You know, I talk about, right. Oh, there's going to be a bill that's going to come up next week, or that bill is never going to happen, or, you know, there's going to be that hearing. You know, and you and I, because we cover this, we have, quote, insider information, close quote, which really isn't insider information. And then there's a hearing on that. And then, say, a stock changes and it goes up. But, you know, anybody who was paying attention, frankly, could have that. So I don't know how you can enforce that. Where's that line that they draw to, cut off, quote, insider trading? That's why there was always criticism of that regulation.
The other question that I've presented to those behind this push is it fair to include spouses? They're not elected officials. What is the thinking behind that?
Well, you know, spouses talk. And if you have members of Congress going home and they say, okay, you know, I'm not trading the stock, but my family is, and it's the same bank account, and it's the same home, and it's the same boat, and the same car, and everything else, you know, that's a problem. Now, but again, that's the slippery slope. How far down does this go? And Jared, you see all the time that members of Congress face some criticism up here for something that a spouse did, a wife, a husband, a child, and not, you know, not an adult child, somebody adult, you know, child, who's in business or something. Yeah, absolutely. You know, offspring. You see that all the time. And sometimes that has merit and sometimes it doesn't. But just because they have that last name, you know, or something, they're like, oh, there you go. You know, there was an issue some years ago. I remember a former colleague of mine, someplace else I worked, his wife had given some money to a presidential campaign. He is a journalist. She is not. It wasn't that much money. It came up in a report, but it's a joint bank account. And he gave the money. And then this appeared in a public report, and some people raised some hackles about this. Mm-hmm. He didn't give the money, but it's the perception that he gave the money, even though he didn't, because he's supposed to be independent. And it's the same thing for members of Congress.
Is there an argument, because I've heard this, I think Senator Tuberville made the point that, you know, he's worried that this is going to be a disincentive for people to get involved in politics.
Well, you know, you already give up a lot to get into politics. You give up a lot of privacy, you know, a lot of family time, you know, freedom, frankly, just to do what you want. You know, people are pretty strict about what you can do. There are other rules up here. And some might say that's the cost of doing business. If you're going to be in this game, it is rough and tumble. And we expect our elected officials to be above board. You know, maybe this is just another example of that. That's been the criticism for a long time, about how much, you know, members have to raise in terms of money, you know, how little the pay is for the hours that they work. And I know people talk and joke all the time, oh, they don't really work that hard. But I got news for you. They actually do here on Capitol Hill, whether you like it or not. And that's Democrats and Republicans, frankly. I mean, we don't know that. That's an interesting theory. But that has always been the problem with putting some of these provisions in, because you want some of the best people to run for office. And if that includes people who are active in trading stocks, then maybe we should have them. But then again, does that create other problems, or better yet, bigger problems?
Well, I know Senator Warren, who's behind one of the proposals with Steve Daines, a Republican senator from Montana, has talked about maybe a way to sort of have a phase in, a phase out kind of way to eliminate some of those concerns. I'll finish with this, Chad. You started this conversation by saying this has built momentum awfully quickly. How quickly then do we maybe see action on? And as I said, there are a few proposals out there. So how quickly does something sort of come together and we start to see votes on this in the House and the Senate?
I wouldn't rule out sometime in the spring, frankly.
Wow.
They have to get through a Supreme Court nomination. That'll be in the spring in the Senate. They have to fund the government. Mm-hmm. So they're going to do another interim bill here in the Senate probably next week. And then also then the bigger bill, which seems to be worked out. And we'll see if that dog hunts, actually. And that's sometime in early March. And they're not doing Build Back Better. They're not changing the filibuster, although, you know, versions of the Build Back Better might come back as we get deeper into the year, late spring, summertime.
Nothing on voting rights.
Right. Voting rights. So you look at the legislative traffic and there's not a lot out there. There's a lot of attention on this. You know, it's kind of like the issue that gurgled up as well over the past couple of weeks is the unionization issue for House staff. Now, again, I thought it was interesting that they thought there might even be a vote in the past week on the resolution, not saying that, you know, staffers were going to unionize right away. That seems like that needs some time to work out. But again, that could probably come in the next couple of months, too. It's just interesting. You know, nothing exists in a vacuum, Jared. And if you don't have, you know, you're not every day Build Back Better. You know, we were on the air every day with that and infrastructure for months. That's all we talked about. And pretty soon, all we will be talking about is the Supreme Court nominee and the confirmation process, especially if it skids off the rails or there's a problem a la Kavanaugh or something and the nominee's background comes out or it's too controversial or something like that. So guess what? These two issues bubbled up to the surface. And that's why we're talking about stock trading and the unionization, collective bargaining for staff here on Capitol Hill.
Well, we'll see what we're talking about next week. Chad, appreciate the time, as always, my friend.
Pleasure. And who day?
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, inflation hits a 40-year high. What steps can the Fed take to bring down prices at grocery stores and gas stations? And Democrats may have won the redistricting battle, but is it enough to turn fortunes for control of the U.S. House? Until then, I'm Jared Halpern.
Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.